Trump imposes tariffs on steel and aluminum.
He said that these deals were going to, quote, make America rich again.
Cleaning up in Goma.
Regardless of whether they are prisoners, it is truly heartbreaking. They have been there for more than 2 weeks. The smells are everywhere, everywhere. Truly, it is very heartbreaking.
And is it time to get rid of the penny?
It's not necessary we need a change for work. Quarters and pennies, everything. If they stop doing it, it's no good for me.
Today is Tuesday, February 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. In Washington Monday evening, President Donald Trump announced new 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imported into the U.S. Here's Arati Tarapayan of Reuters with some of the numbers.
With President Donald Trump targeting steel and aluminum, here's a breakdown of where the U.S. gets those metals. Roughly a quarter of all steel in the U.S. is imported from neighbors Mexico and Canada, or overseas allies like Japan, Germany, and South Korea. Canada and Mexico accounted for almost 40% of U.S. steel imports in 2024. 6.6 million net tons of steel mill products were imported from Canada, and 3.5 million came from Mexico, according to U.S. Census Bureau data via the American Iron and Steel Institute. Brazil was the second largest source of steel imports to the U.S. last year. While China is the world's largest steel producer and exporter, very little of that is sent to the U.S. Most Chinese steel was shut out of the market when 25% tariffs were imposed in 2018. Roughly half of all aluminum used in the U.S. is imported, with the vast majority coming from Canada. At 3.2 million metric tons last year, Canadian imports were twice the next nine countries combined, according to the U.S. Department of Commerce. The next largest sources of imports are the United Arab Emirates, at around 347,000 metric tons, and China at around 223,000 metric tons. The U.S. aluminum smelting industry is small by global standards. Total smelter capacity in the country was just 1.7% of the global total, according to the U.S. Geological Survey.
Arati Tarapayan of Reuters reporting for us. It was indeed a busy evening at the White House. Along with the tariffs, Trump gave an ultimatum to Hamas and signed several executive orders and spoke with reporters. To help me catch up on all of it, I'm joined by VOA's White House correspondent, Anita Powell.
As he signed these very big executive orders in the Oval Office this evening, he said that these deals were going to, quote, make America rich again, because Trump believes that these deals, that putting a 25% tariff on these important construction products will shore up American manufacturing of these very important goods, that this will make more made in America goods, and this will give a jolt to the economy. A lot of economists believe, however, that the cost of tariffs is passed directly onto the consumer, and this is going to lead to price increases in the meantime.
This has been something he's been talking about for quite a long time.
Right. This is something that he attempted in his first term in 2018. He imposed these 10% tariffs, and there were, of course, some exemptions to that rule, and it's not clear whether these exceptions will remain or not. But they did remain in place for most of Biden's presidency, actually, until he increased them to 25% today.
Along with tariffs, the president had a few other things on his mind, namely the hostages still being held by Hamas in Gaza. What did he say about that?
Right. So Trump reissued an updated, one could say, his ultimatum that, quote, all hell will break loose. Now he is setting a noon deadline for all hostages to be released from Hamas, or as he said, ceasefire could be canceled. That's very ominous. The ceasefire is still in its early weeks. As you recall, it was negotiated kind of on the cusp of the Biden-Trump turnover. And so this is a 42-day ceasefire that leads to the release of most of the hostages and paves the path to an eventual peace plan. But of course, that was affected last week when Trump spoke those words about, quote, owning Gaza and rebuilding Gaza, and implying that there would be strong American participation and even perhaps ownership of the contested Gaza Strip.
So along with the tariffs and along with a demand for the hostages' release, Trump also signed an order regarding drinking straws. Anita, what's the story there?
This only applies to federal government procurement. He signed an executive order saying that the U.S. federal government, which is the largest consumer of these types of commercial products, will go back to plastic straws. And he said that paper straws and biodegradable straws that have been used instead, quote, don't work. And he, in fact, said that he's had them break and, quote, explode on him.
Now, I understand that tariffs and hostages have been a hot-button political issue here in the United States for quite some time. Have drinking straws been that big an issue in the public consciousness?
I guess it would depend who you speak to. I mean, for Donald Trump, this has apparently been a preoccupation for a matter of years. In the United States, there are businesses that offer biodegradable bamboo straws, and of course, they are a slightly different product than the old-fashioned plastic straws, but we haven't seen any mass demonstrations. We haven't seen any organized political campaign about this. We haven't seen any public outcry, any violence, or any really high-end political rhetoric until President Trump brought it back before us today.
So, Anita, this is all coming quite fast, and to be honest, we knew the tariffs were coming. We didn't know about the ultimatum to Hamas, and we certainly didn't know about the drinking straws. This seems to be a recurring pattern in Trump's second administration. Lots of executive orders, little notice. Makes it hard for the press, no?
Right. So one difficulty in looking at these executive orders is, so far, the administration has communicated them solely through the president, and then they will put the executive orders up for the rest of us to see, but they don't always share with us ahead of time any sort of evidence-based arguments to support what they purport to do, show the extent of what they purport to do. We just know kind of the broad outlines when the president signs them, and then he says, this is what this is going to do. And that makes it hard to report on them because we don't have all of the details about what these even plan to do. We just know what the Trump administration says they are going to do. And as we've seen in every White House since reporters and presidents were created, we have seen a gap between what the administration presents it's going to do and what it may actually do. And also, it doesn't leave room for knowledgeable criticism about this plan if we don't know what it is. And so this opacity, which is interesting in contrast to the transparency that you see on the surface of the Trump administration, this opacity in the actual mechanisms of how they do things, how much they want to do, what tools they want to use, is very interesting because it doesn't give us anything to grasp onto in telling you how they're doing what they're doing. And that's an important part of the puzzle.
And we'll have to leave it there for today. Anita Powell, VOA's White House correspondent. Anita, thanks for your reporting today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
President Trump says Palestinians living in Gaza would now be moved to an unspecified location outside the territory and have no right to return under his plan. Trump, in an interview with Fox News released on Monday, called his plan for the narrow territory along the shores of the Mediterranean Sea a, quote, real estate development for the future. I would own it, he said, adding that the 2.3 million Palestinians now living there would be moved to as many as six different sites outside Gaza under a plan that the Arab world, as well as U.S. allies and adversaries alike, have already rejected. Trump did not say where the Palestinians would be relocated to, but when asked by Fox anchor Brett Baer if they would be allowed to return home to Gaza, Trump said, no, they wouldn't, because they're going to have much better housing. Also on Sunday, U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz responded to critics of Trump's Gaza takeover plan. And on the ground in the Middle East, the Israel-Hamas truce resulted in another successful hostage-for-prisoners exchange. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias has the story.
The Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal continues to hold. Israeli troops withdrew Sunday from the Netzarim corridor that divides the Gaza Strip. and entire Palestinian families made their way back home to northern Gaza. What lies ahead for Gaza's inhabitants after the war ends, however, remains an open question. U.S. President Donald Trump has floated the idea of Gaza's population resettling in other countries and the United States taking over the Gaza Strip to rebuild it. Trump's National Security Advisor Mike Waltz responded Sunday to critics of the plan. He appeared on NBC's Meet the Press.
You can't get to post-construction. Yes. You can't make this the Paris of the Mediterranean like Beirut was back in the 70s and give these people a better life if you've got 1.8 million people living in absolute squalor in mountains and mountains and mountains of debris. For anyone, the media included, that doesn't like what he is proposing, come to us with a better plan.
Trump's plan has received support inside Israel, but the Arab world and the Palestinian leadership categorically reject it. Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour.
We need to rebuild the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is a very precious component of the land of the State of Palestine. It is part of our homeland, and we don't have a homeland other than the State of Palestine.
Meanwhile, Israelis celebrated the release of more hostages this weekend. Five Thai workers who had been held by Hamas for more than a year reunited Sunday with their loved ones. And 183 Palestinian prisoners also reclaimed their freedom as part of the deal. Talks on the second phase of the Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal could resume in Qatar as soon as this week. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
We've been reporting here on the recent violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, and though the fighting may have stopped for now, the cleanup is just getting started. Reuters correspondent David Doyle takes us to a prison in Goma, where the bodies are still being recovered.
Volunteers in protective clothing were removing decomposing bodies from the Muzenze prison in eastern Congo's Goma on Monday. That grim task, taking place 2 weeks after clashes between Rwanda-backed rebels and the Congolese army, led to a mass escape from the facility. Teams from the International Committee of the Red Cross were clearing and disinfecting damaged buildings to prevent health risks. Goma resident Pacifique Mugulwa, who lives near the prison, said children had been wandering around the area, leaving them exposed to disease.
Regardless of whether they are prisoners, it is truly heartbreaking. They have been there for more than 2 weeks. The smells are everywhere, everywhere. Truly, it is very heartbreaking.
A rebel alliance spearheaded by the M23 group seized Goma on January 27th. It is the worst escalation in fighting in eastern Congo in more than a decade, and has left thousands dead. Despite announcing a unilateral ceasefire, the rebels have continued to march south towards the city of Bukavu. At the weekend, leaders from eastern and southern African blocs held an unprecedented joint summit with the aim of defusing the crisis. The summit urged all parties to hold direct talks, though Congo has repeatedly refused to hold such talks with the M23. The first ever summit between the two blocs reflects the continent's deep concern over the violence and the standoff between Congo and neighboring Rwanda, which denies allegations it is fueling the conflict with its own troops and weapons.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Jurors heard how a knife attack on novelist Salman Rushdie unfolded in a matter of seconds in a 2022 lecture, and how close he came to death in the prosecutor's opening statement on Monday at the trial of the man accused of trying to murder the author. Rushdie had worried for his safety since his 1989 novel, The Satanic Verses, was denounced as blasphemous by many Muslims and led to Iran's then Ayatollah issuing a fatwa calling for his death. Rushdie spent years in hiding but traveled freely over the past quarter century after Iran announced it would not enforce the decree. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Monday that members of President Trump's team will travel to Ukraine this week. Zelensky, who's trying to forge close relations with Trump as the president seeks to rapidly end the war, said the visit would take place before the Munich Security Conference. That goes from February 14th to 16th. A bus veered off a highway bridge into a polluted ravine in Guatemala City early on Monday, killing at least 51 people. The densely packed bus was traveling into the capital when it plunged approximately 20 meters from Puente Belte, a highway bridge that crosses over a road and a creek. Images shared by the fire department on social media showed the bus partially submerged in wastewater, surrounded by victims' bodies. Guatemalan President Bernardo Arvalo declared 3 days of national mourning and deployed the country's army and disaster agency to assist response efforts. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at American politics, on Monday night, President Trump ordered the U.S. Treasury to stop manufacturing pennies, America's one-cent coin. Trump wrote on social media, quote, "For far too long, the United States has minted pennies, which literally cost us more than 2 cents. This is so wasteful. I have instructed my Secretary of the U.S. Treasury to stop producing new pennies." The penny was first introduced by the government in 1793, and since 1909, the profile of President Abraham Lincoln has been featured on the coin. A debate has been rumbling for years over whether the penny should be dropped from the lineup of American currency. For many Americans, the coin has become a nuisance that ends up being discarded in drawers, ashtrays, and piggy banks, while supporters of the penny have argued that it helps keep consumer prices lower and is a source of income to charities. If the penny were to disappear, prices would, of course, need to be adjusted, but accounting for sales tax would be difficult. Sarwar Kamal is a shopkeeper in New York City.
If there were no tax, then we could have priced our goods at, let's say, 105 or 110 or 125. But since there are tax we have to include, most of the price usually winds up with, let's say, 106 or 107. And then we have to deal with the pennies. How we'll do that, we don't know yet.
Additionally, removing pennies from circulation will make it hard on small businesses, such as food trucks, coffee carts, newspaper stands, and the like, that survive on selling large quantities of inexpensive items. Rosa Guaman operates a food truck.
It's not necessary we need a change for work. Quarters and pennies, everything. If they stop doing it, it's no good for me.
Canada stopped producing pennies in 2012, and although the coins are still legal to use, most prices there now must end in a 5 or a 0. In the U.S., it's unclear whether a president has the power to unilaterally eliminate the 1 cent coin. Meanwhile, as the debate about foreign aid rages on in the U.S., families around the world are bearing the brunt of Washington's clampdown on spending. Reuters' Diane To takes us to Thailand.
In Thailand's northeast Thak province, far away from Washington, D.C., a family is preparing for a funeral as the fallout of U.S. President Donald Trump's foreign aid freeze hits some of the poorest parts of the world. Burmese refugee Pika Lau was in a hospital funded by the U.S. through the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, when it was ordered to close. Her family says the 71-year-old, who had lung problems, became short of breath after she was sent back to a refugee camp and died 4 days later. This is her son-in-law, Tin Win.
My mother-in-law was not in a critical condition when she came home. I am sure nothing would have happened if she still had an oxygen tank. She died due to the lack of oxygen tanks in the camp.
The IRC closed hospitals in several refugee camps in late January after receiving a stop work order from the U.S. State Department, according to residents and aid workers. They were serving tens of thousands of people who are unable to go back to conflict-ridden Myanmar. The spending freeze Trump ordered when he took office on January 20th is supposed to last 90 days while his administration reviews all foreign aid programs. Trump and billionaire Elon Musk, who is heading his drive to shrink the federal government, including the U.S. Agency for International Development, have said the move is necessary to root out wasteful spending. But its impact has rippled around the world, hitting those like Pikalau's daughter, who tells Reuters how much she misses her mother. I would take shelter in my mother's house sometimes after I fought with my husband, she said. As a daughter, I am so sad that I no longer have my mother around to scold me. The loss of U.S. foreign aid has left Thai authorities and refugee groups trying to fill the gap, as state-run hospitals like this one scramble to treat refugees in need. Local community leader Mong Kho says Thai officials have stepped in to provide support, like oxygen tanks, though sources say there's not been enough. But what will happen if the crisis occurs longer, he asks. We hope that the Thai government will sort out the issues within 90 days. We wonder what will happen to us after 90 days. An IRC spokesperson told Reuters, quote, to hear of this loss of life is devastating, and we offer our condolences to the family and friends of Pikalau. The U.S. Embassy in Bangkok did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
It's Diane To of Reuters reporting for us. So-called birth tourism is not only happening on the U.S. mainland. Pregnant Chinese mothers have been heading to a U.S. territory much closer to home to have their babies and obtain for them coveted U.S. citizenship. From VOA's Mandarin service, Yu Yao and Zhu Dao have the details from Saipan, the capital of the Northern Mariana Islands, in this report narrated for us by Elizabeth Lee.
Tourists may come to Saipan, the capital of the Northern Mariana Islands, for its Pacific island beauty, but not this mother. She's here so her daughter can acquire a piece of paper that says she's a U.S. citizen. The mother has overstayed the 14 days she's allowed to be in this U.S. territory. She only uses her surname, Ye, to protect her identity.
Whether it's the education system or the everyday environment within China, there's too much pressure. Even I want to escape. I don't want to be there.
Ye arrived in Saipan in September, entering under a 14-day visa waiver program for Chinese citizens implemented in 2019. Before that, when birth tourism from China was at its highest, Chinese nationals were allowed to stay without a visa for 45 days. Arnold Palacios is the governor of the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands.
It peaked in 2017 and 2018.
With more than 500 babies born to Chinese mothers in each of those years, Palacio says those births surpassed the number born to Saipan women. Palacio says in 2024, 55 babies were born to Chinese mothers. Taking care of mothers who fly in just to give birth has been a challenge for the hospital staff and a risk for the women themselves, he says.
When these women come in to give birth, they don't have any prenatal records. So, you know, they have no idea really whether it's a high-risk birth or what.
Since 2009, government records show about 3,300 babies have been born here to Chinese mothers. Ye says she found Saipan on social media while researching places to give birth.
I didn't have time to apply for a visa because it involves a wait time. The pregnancy was a surprise. I picked this place because it was the place I could get to quickly to achieve what I wanted.
Ye is applying for her one-month-old daughter's U.S. passport. She's also paying more to have it ready within 3 weeks.
I'm afraid the policy will be impacted now that Trump is president, so I paid extra to get the passport quicker.
Conservatives in the U.S. have argued that birthright citizenship encourages illegal immigration and is being exploited.
We think we have good ground.
On his first day in office, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to end it. While this order is being challenged in court, Ye hopes there will be a good outcome for her daughter and maybe even herself.
I feel once I get here, it's a more humane place.
Since the end of last year, travelers from China have to apply online for a waiver and be vetted through an electronic pre-screening process before they're allowed to enter. For Yu Yao and Zhou Dao in Saipan, Northern Mariana Islands, Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.